Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in the midst of wars and inflation, recession, and natural disasters of all kinds, and what at times nowadays seems like threats to the very continuation of our democracy, NASA is always a constant, sending missions into space to seek discoveries about what lies beyond our troubled big blue marble in space. And there's never anything political involved, just science and engineering feats that appeal to our sense of wonder and adventure, inspiring us to lift our eyes to the nighttime skies and contemplate what's out there and how small we really are in the larger scheme of things. I know I'm sounding lyrical here, but my gosh, I mean, I don't think we appreciate that enough. NASA's latest big mission is the James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST for short, launched from the European Space Agency's base in French Guiana on Christmas Day last year in 2021. It's described as the largest and most complex space science observatory ever built. My guest is John Durning, who's the JWST's Deputy Project Manager at Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. As Deputy Project Manager, Mr. Durning is a key leader in all aspects of the development of the flight hardware and software items for the Webb Telescope. Welcome, John.
Glad to be here, Court.
Well, thanks for being on. I know you've been a little busy lately. We appreciate you being on with us today. When we talk about a telescope, most people generally picture a big tube with some lenses on it, but space telescopes have huge mirrors that focus the light on different instruments, and the Webb is really a collection of a lot of different instruments using infrared spectroscopy. So just briefly, John, what are some of those instruments?
So we have four instruments on board the observatory. There are a near-spec instrument that takes the infrared light and breaks it up into its spectra, various chemical compositions, frequency-based. We have the near-infrared camera that takes the beautiful pictures that we release and we will continue to release going forward. And then we have a near-infrared slit spectrometer. That was from Canada, provided by the Canadian Space Agency, and that is a similar camera that has a little spectroscopy to it. The near-spec instrument that I mentioned is a contribution from the European Space Agency. And then we have the MIRI, which is mid-infrared imager. The near-infrared works in the infrared band that is the shortest wavelength, the beginning part of the infrared spectrum. And MIRI, which is the mid-infrared, as its name implies, goes into the middle of the infrared spectrum. You know, so that one produces a lot of the beautiful cloud structures we see. So those are the four instruments. MIRI is a combination of a NASA and European consortium provided instrument. We provided some key components to the instrument, and then NASA and the ESA consortium put those in their overall instrument and then returned it back to us. Those are the four instruments. And then we have the fine guider, which provided by the Canadians, that also helps us point. It is the one that points us to the target stars.
Yeah, so for some of our listeners who may not be really clear about what infrared is, the electromagnetic spectrum is very wide and includes, you know, ultraviolet and infrared, and the visible spectrum of light that we see is only part of that. So the infrared is kind of best known as the portion of the spectrum that picks up heat, like night vision goggles. When you see that eerie kind of ghost-like images of people running around, it's really seeing the heat they give off. So these instruments are seeing heat out there, but they're turning them into visual images through computer manipulation of the graphics of that. And I mean, to give our listeners an idea of its sensitivity, the Webb can detect the heat of a bumblebee as far away as the moon, if you can imagine such a thing. I don't think you could detect the heat of a bumblebee from 20 feet away very easily. So that's extremely sensitive. And the instruments are that sensitive. So is that accurate that you're looking for heat in the far, far distant reaches beyond our galaxy of the universe?
That's exactly so, Court. Basically, JWST was specifically designed to operate in infrared because Hubble, visible light gets blocked by the clouds and the dust clouds and the particles that are out there in deep space. And you need infrared to go penetrate those dust clouds. And so we were specifically designed to operate looking for these heat signatures. It also happens to be when an object, much like the Doppler effect from sound, sound sounds differently when it's coming toward you from going away. Light has that same phenomenon. It's called redshift if it's expanding. Universe is expanding, so Everything is moved away from everything else. So things that have been produced in the visible light in those distant galaxies, by the time it gets to us, it has Doppler shifted or redshifted into the infrared. So part of the data processing is to... we see the spectra come in the infrared, and we can say, this is carbon, this is various molecules, this is hydrogen, this is helium. We know what it's supposed to look like in the visible, so we can calculate how much it shifted in the infrared. And that's one of the ways we calculate how far it shifted as it's traveled.
Okay, so that's a good explanation. You mentioned the Hubble quickly, John, and so people may not realize, but the Hubble Space Telescope was the predecessor space telescopic platform to the Webb from about 30 years ago. And we'll talk about that later on in the comparison between the two, but I guess it operated in the visible light spectrum as opposed to the infrared is kind of the main big fundamental technical difference between the two. So to get back on the Webb, what's its overall mission at the 30,000 or 30 million foot level?
So there are four fundamental science principles. See the first light after the Big Bang. There was a cosmic dark ages where there wasn't enough gravitational pull to get all the mass together to compress enough to create heat. So at some point, they estimate 400 million years after the Big Bang is when enough of the matter that was out there in the universe condensed around each other to compress, generate a heat signal. So it used to be called the first light machine. We wanted to see the first light generated in the universe. And then we wanted to understand how did the Earth become the way it is and how did our Milky Way evolve to make it such that we're here. So once you see the first light, you can see everything between now and the first light. You see how everything evolved. Once you know that, you can more intelligently look around and see other situations that evolved similarly. Are there distant planets around distant stars that seem in that galaxy that star is in? Did it evolve like our Milky Way evolved? So that would help us better narrow our focus to look for extraterrestrial life by figuring out where are the similar evolution trails going, and then we can look at those. There's satellites out there now that are finding thousands of exoplanets everywhere. Everywhere they look, they find them around almost every star. So that would be an untenable task for us, because one of the other science goals is to see, are we alone? And so we couldn't look everywhere for the limited time we have, which even if it's 25 years, there's still a vast space out there. So this understanding the evolution will help us narrow our focus. That's one thing. So we want to understand how we evolve, how does the planets form, and then are we alone out there? And we won't make direct measurements of other aliens and other planets, but we will be able to determine chemical composition of those distant planets' atmospheres. And from that, we can infer, if we see water, we see methane, we see carbon, things that we need for life here on Earth, we can draw from that depending on the composition of it. There is some sort of biological process going on that planet, and that's pretty darn exciting.
Yeah, it's always an interesting concept to me, and it's a different subject that we don't have time to get into here, but we're always looking in terms of looking for signs of potential life on exoplanets, on other planets than our own. We're always looking for an organic base, as if all life must be organic rather than some completely different energy form that has nothing to do with carbon. You know, so it's a kind of an anthropomorphism in a way to look that way, it seems to me. But anyway, like I say, it's a different topic. You talk about looking for first light, I guess, and you're talking about looking far enough out to the outer limits of our known universe to around the time the Big Bang occurred, which is a mind-boggling concept. It's just bizarre to think you can see out far enough to see that far back in time. But how far out are we talking about? Is it possible to even say in terms of light years or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a previous mission called COBE that was able to discover the moments after the Big Bang by a cosmological map in the microwave measurement. Our lead scientist, John Mather, actually won his Nobel Prize for that mission. And so we know 13.8 billion years ago that that's when the Big Bang, based on the data we have today. We know from that theory that about 13.4 or 13.5 billion years in the past is when the first light was emanated. So we anticipate, just like Hubble did in its day, we anticipate JWST will rewrite all these theories once we get actual measurements. But I will tell you that the very famous Hubble Deep Field that helped determine the age of the universe, it took Hubble 10 to 14 days to dwell in that one spot to resolve that image. Mm-hmm. We beat that deep field image in 2 hours. Last week we released the image. And in that image, through a very cursory look, we found the oldest galaxy we currently have determined in that image is 13.1 billion years in the past. We know that because how far the spectral image has redshifted into the infrared signature. So we've already gone in 2 hours, 13.1 billion years in the past. And we have programs in the first year of science where we will dwell in one spot for 10 to 14 days. I don't know what's the beginning, but whatever it is, we should be able to see it.
Incredible. Well, just briefly, the further out you look, does matter get thinner and thinner, you know, farther and farther between galaxies, that kind of thing? Does it get more sparse because the universe is newer and less populated and less evolved at that point?
The matter that happened in the beginning is the same matter we have today. It's in different forms. And right after the Big Bang, it was mostly energy, and then there were dust clouds, and then from the dust clouds, they converged, making various components into a star, and then the stars explode and create elements, heavier elements. In the beginning, there was only hydrogen, helium, the basic elements. They condensed together to make the stars, like our star is mostly helium, and then they supernova, and they generate, from that energy, they generate iron and all the heavier elements, and we are made of that, basically, stardust. It is fainter and fainter because, as you can just imagine, there are very few photons that are making it into our field of view. So, but we can resolve tens of photons, whereas your eye requires millions of photons to resolve something. Yeah, so it is a fainter object, which is why we have to be colder than what we're looking at. So otherwise, we'll just see ourselves in the noise. So.
Where is the Webb orbiting? How far out is it?
It's orbiting at the L2, Lagrangian point number 2. There are 6 Lagrangian points around the Earth. These are just mathematical constructs of locations around the Earth where the gravitational pull of the various heavenly bodies are neutralized. In this case, L2 is on the furthest side of Earth from the sun. L1 is on the closest side. So there are solar missions that study our sun that are sitting at L1. L2 is 1 million miles from Earth, so 4 times the distance from the moon is where we're sitting. And that mathematical location stays in that relative position around the Earth as it rotates around the sun, and we stay on the anti-sun side of the Earth. Not in the shadow, because we need the solar power. So we just orbit in a very big halo orbit around this virtual point. And as the Earth rotates around the sun, this virtual point rotates with it, and we rotate virtually around that. So in 1 year, we will go all the way around the sun, just like the Earth does. We go there versus Hubble on low Earth orbit, because Hubble was in the visible, so it didn't care too much about temperature. So it had sunrises and sunsets every 45 minutes, and that was very dynamic. Because we are extremely cold and we want to stay extremely cold, we need to be thermally stable. L2, we stay always pointing away from the sun, is an incredibly thermally stable location. That's why we chose it.
Okay, got it. We're talking with John Durning, who is the Deputy Project Manager for the James Webb Space Telescope, the Webb Space Telescope that was launched back in December 2021 and is just now flooding us with these incredible images from deep, deep space. So once the telescope was on orbit, John, what was going on for the first 6 months or so, the first half of 2022, before the images began to be made public?
So the first 6 months are the commissioning phase, where in the first month, once we launch, we separate from the launch vehicle, and then we begin our deployments. You know, we're a very large telescope, 21 feet across, no fairing in a rocket, has a 21-foot diameter. So the biggest one is 15 feet or so. So we had to fold up like an origami, or like a Hollywood Transformer. Then we get into orbit, and the first 2 weeks is when we complete all the deployments. Our sun shield, first our solar array gets deployed, and then our sun shield gets deployed. That's our thermal umbrella that keeps the sun off us. And then the telescope itself deployed. And then after those 2 weeks, you know, we started checking out and aligning the telescope. It takes about 29 days to get to L2. So by the time we got to L2, we were fully deployed, and we were almost at temperature. Once we get at our temperature, and our operating temperature is minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit, the coldest anything can be is minus 464 degrees Fahrenheit. We have one instrument that is only a few degrees above absolute zero, minus 444, 450 degrees Fahrenheit. So it took a while to get those cool. So while they're cooling, the instruments were being turned on, getting out of their stasis state, making sure they're checking out. And once we turn the instruments on to make sure they all worked, then each instrument are incredibly complicated pieces of equipment. And so they took 4 months to calibrate and make sure all the various modes and features of the instrument are working properly. And throughout the 6 months, we had very few hiccups along the way. We spent hundreds of hours, I would say thousands of man hours, generating contingency plans for any eventual hiccup in orbit. And we had stacks of paper, you know, several reams thick of just one volume of contingency plans, ready to go if we needed them. Hmm. Amazingly, we had not needed any of those contingency plans. So all that manpower effort was just thrown away, because now that we're fully operational and fully deployed, those contingency plans were not needed. And that's, you could say that's a waste of resources, but that's the best kind of waste. It means that we didn't have any problems. And so it was great.
Like anything else, if you hadn't done that, things would have fallen apart and all hell would have broken loose.
Exactly. So the fact that you had prepared warded it off.
So then the images started to come in, and the first full color image from the web was released July 11th during a public event at the White House. But the next day, the 12th, really the flood of images really began to appear and became one of those rare things, actually a big international news story about a scientific achievement. So, you know, many of our listeners have seen that eerie image with a brownish landscape of shapes that look like they're called mountains and valleys, you know, with a star-speckled blue space kind of sky-looking thing above it. What is that image, John?
So that's the Carina Nebula, and it is a spectacular image. The brown that you see are the dust, the nebula itself, which is the dust cloud. And it has these weird contours because what's happening, and you're just seeing the edge of the nebula. If you looked in other areas of the nebula, you would see poles that look like they're holes in the brown spot. What that is remnants of stars that have exploded in supernovae. While it looks like a mountain, really, what it really is dust clouds being pushed out. So the area that's above the brown spot, the deep space looking things with their stars, those stars supernovaed and blew out the dust cloud in the nebula. Either that is supernovaed, or they actually, that material is condensed in onto itself and created a little hole of where the volume of the dust cloud compressed into one. So all along that nebula, it's showing, for lack of a term, it's like windswept. It's as these stars supernova, their energy blows out and scatters the dust clouds or pushes the dust clouds into other stars nearby. So like it looks like there's a bulbous thing sticking out. That is basically a wave of energy from an exploding star coming through and working its way around an existing star that's forming. So all these, you know, these stars that are within the nebula, those are stars that have condensed enough energy to turn on. The ones that show big inside the nebula, big open spaces, like a little vacuum space, that's where a star exploded and blew out the nebula. It's really fascinating. And the quality of the resolution of these images, you can download them at the NASA site, and yourself, they're 8K res. You can zoom in and you can see all kinds of details of stars and galaxies within the nebula doing all kinds of things to the nebula itself.
It's one of the drawbacks of radio, of course, that you can't see the pictures, so it forces us to use our imaginations to try to picture in our minds what you're describing. And most people have seen that particular image. I think that's the most famous one so far. But there are a lot of amazing images coming in. And in fact, you can go to jwst.nasa.gov, and you can access all kinds of these images more and more every day, I think. Let's switch to kind of the discoveries that the telescope is making. I think what we were just describing is maybe the first time that previously invisible areas of star birth were now being seen, and that alone is a, you know, kind of mind-blowing thing. But in just its first few days, the telescope is making a lot of major new discoveries, and maybe let's talk about a few of them. Like there's the first deep field, Webb's first deep field. What is that about?
So that is the field that we stared at for 2 hours. The whole point of these early release images is not science as much as demonstrating the capability of the observatory. Hubble and James Webb work is that they're a facility class. They're open to the world scientists to propose what they want to do with this asset. So every year, Hubble did it and we're continuing it. We issue requests for proposals and say, okay, this asset's here. What do you want to do with it? And they submit proposals, and then we will select, not we, but the science community within NASA will select the proposals that have merit. So we've selected the proposals for the next year of observing time already. And so what these images do is they show this is the capability of this observatory. So plan accordingly for your science. One of the images we released was an image of a spectrum of an atmosphere around a distant planet, around a star that's, I think it's 2 million light years away. And what it shows is our resolution being able to measure the atmosphere of that distant planet. It's pretty spectacular. So now scientists can take that information and say, oh, okay, well, I want to look at that planet. This is just the tip of the iceberg. We're just demonstrating what it can be done And in the next year, we are going to be observing exoplanets that have Earth-like conditions. Hopefully, we'll be able to measure those atmospheres and see what's in the atmospheres of those distant planets. It's just pretty darn spectacular and exciting to think about. We think the beginning of the universe is 13.5 billion years ago. We'll measure and we'll get data back, and maybe we'll see something further. And that'll be exciting still. We'll just say, wow, I guess we were wrong with our theories. Let's rewrite the books, because James Webb is telling us like it is. And so we can go with theoretical stuff, but once we get measurements, we got to go back and check theory and say, does that hold with our theory? And the answer is no. Then theory's wrong because measurement is right.
So there's another thing. You can look at details of what's called the Southern Ring Planetary Nebula that astronomers could never see before. Tell us just briefly a little bit about that.
Yes, that's another case where in the different frequencies, the mid-infrared and the near-infrared, you can see structure. And what they see, they believe, is in the center, some cosmological event happened, creating great energy. And when this energy expands out into the nebula, that ring is the dust being excited by that energy and lighting up. What the scientists are saying is, okay, then we can calculate how much energy was in the center based on how much luminosity this light has, and calculate what is actually going on in the center of that. But it looks spectacular, which it is, of course.
Yeah, right. So to put it in like more terrestrial terms, it'd be like dropping a rock in a pond and then the concentric rings going out from it. And if you can measure the rings and the height of the water, the waves that are produced, you could kind of deduce the size and mass of the rock that created them to start with, something like that, maybe.
Exactly so. You'll see something about a shock wave comes out and hits you. Based on where it originated from, you can calculate the energy that created that shock wave. All true. Good analogy.
There's another thing with an interesting term, a galaxy group called Stevens Quintet, which offhand sounds like a jazz group. But in fact, if as big as the Milky Way galaxy is, this is a group of five galaxies that interact with each other. So talk just briefly about that, Stevens Quintet,
sure,
and what we can see about that.
So it's called Stefan's Quintet, named after the person who discovered it in the mid-1800s. And so there are five galaxies. There's four to the right of the image that are dancing with each other. They're around the same relative space. And there's another galaxy to the left. That one is a galaxy in the foreground. It's not in the same relative space as the other four. But the other four are essentially consuming each other. They're in a terminal dance where they will, all four of those will merge and create a super galaxy. And so what we hadn't seen before was the details of basically the tendrils of these different galaxies, these spiral galaxies, interacting with each other and creating energy and lighting up. So,
yeah, so you mentioned before, John, the European Space Agency and Canadian Space Agency contributing elements to this mission. And so actually the whole telescope project is a partnership with them, which is a pretty unusual thing, you know, with different governments. So has that kind of multi-agency, multinational aspect of the project made it more complicated to manage? I mean, I think that's a rhetorical question. I assume it did, you know.
Yeah.
Tell us about that just very briefly.
Yeah, it did complicate things quite a lot. One of the main complications, well, there's funding complications. Each agency from each country has to get their money from their own representatives, and that gets complicated. There's that complication when you start the program. But also, just exchanging technical information, even though CSA and European Space Agency are partners and they are on friendly terms with all those nations, there is technology transfer concerns that cause us to not be able to have frank and open technical conversations with each one of those entities. So when they have a technical challenge, we can't really help them solve it, because that would then impart some U.S. technical knowledge that wasn't already there. Consequently, you know, they can't transfer information to us when they'll rocket. So it adds complications both in the coordinating the logistics of getting things delivered, but also in the ability to deliver things and have frank and open technical conversations. This mission is not unique to that. Every international collaboration has these constraints that we successfully work around, and it's not insurmountable, but it just adds a complication to make sure we maintain our technical integrity and yet still get the hardware we need.
Yeah, so it's kind of pros and cons to it. You get greater versatility and power with the mission from the contributions you get to it, but you got to deal with the process of getting them at the same time, which complicates things. So
exactly so.
I said at the beginning we would talk about the Hubble telescope, and we're just getting to the end of the show here. We've got a couple of minutes to cover something that's kind of complex in a way, but I remember the telescope when it was launched in 1990 turned out to have a flaw in the manufacture of the lens, that made it initially useless. And it was really one of NASA's biggest failures ever at that point. And eventually a shuttle mission had to be sent to add what amounted to a corrective contact lens on top of the defective one to make it operable. And it finally did get to where it worked perfectly like it was originally intended to. And in fact, it's still in orbit and functioning today. But I was just curious, again, I keep saying this thing briefly because we could talk about this for another hour, but we're running out of time. Was the institutional memory of that bad experience with Hubble a factor in the way the Webb project was planned and run to kind of avoid that sort of major glitch?
Oh, sure. You can't help but learn from your mistakes, right? So, yeah, we recognize the fatal flaw was not being able to end-to-end test the optical system on the Hubble architecture before launch. We did separate components and through modeling calculated it would be okay. So on the James Webb, we certainly took that lesson to heart and made sure that we were able to test the optical train end-to-end. So we kept the photon from the telescope all the way through the optical train to the detectors on the instrument, where Hubble was a monolithic optic. So it, however it was machined on the ground, was the way it was going to be in orbit. The James Webb has adaptive optics. So we can manipulate if for some reason, as we launched all these various hexagon segments, if there was some way they moved on orbit, we can realign them, or even over time, if some thermal environment or some other environment causes an optical change, we have actuators on every segment that can change its shape and bring it back into focus. So between the testing and the architecture we have, we definitely learned from the Hubble experience and made sure we were more robust.
Yeah, so it was definitely just more flexible from the start. We're right at the end of the show, John, but people often criticize, as you know, the space program as being a huge expense when the money could be used to improve the lives of Americans on the ground. And there are always things that we could sink money into to make somebody's lives better, sometimes for some period of time, somehow. People claim, you know, that basically these discoveries are pretty much useless compared to practical, pragmatic things on the ground that could save people's lives, et cetera. But what do you say about that?
That's been quoted. It's $9 billion to launch the James Webb Space Telescope. That's a lot of money, but over 20 years, that averages out to about $450 million a year. Still a lot of money, but if you put it in perspective, the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox payroll every year is $450 million for the two teams.
There you go.
So you could spend that kind of money and have 50 men play out a game for 9 months out of the year to the pleasure of millions of people. That's a noble endeavor. I'm not criticizing that. But, or you can spend a similar amount of money to hire thousands of engineers and technicians and administrative people to labor on high technology jobs, that the result will be an inspiration for everybody in the world. I just think we have enough resources to do both. I just think if you put it in perspective, this investment inspires everybody in the world. And I'm not kidding, the world was moved by this. I mean, that's money well spent in my mind.
Yeah, it's a good analogy, a good statement. Well, listen, this has been so interesting, and we could keep it up for a good while longer, but it's been very informative, and I hope our listeners have learned a lot of things about the Webb Telescope and NASA's discoveries that they wouldn't have known before. To learn even more, if you're interested, there's a comprehensive website, I mentioned it earlier, containing everything you might want to know about the Webb, and it's at jwst.nasa.gov, jwst.nasa.gov. And I want to thank you so much, John Durning, for being on with us. I know you're very busy and for taking the time to do this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Cort. It's my pleasure.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.